que je venais de dire. Mais je vais vous présenter Édouard Boucat, que vous connaissez probablement déjà. Alors, il est artiste, il est un artiste et professeur. Artist and writer. He is recognized for his experimental poetry as well as his books and essays on the expanded notion of electronic literature. Katz created his first digital poem in 1982 and his first online poem in 1985 on the Digital Network. He also created the first holographic poem, writing in light in 3D space and exploring holography's unique temporal possibilities. He is also a pioneer of telecommunication art in the free web, telepresence, and bio art. He is also the author of many books, like Media Poetry and Odibis Potax, an anthology of all his poetry until 2007. Trouver ses livres sont disponibles parmi d'autres à l'entrée de l'exposition DLO au Centre de design de l'UQAM. He has received many awards, including the prestigious Golden Mika Award from Ars Electronica. Katz's work has been exhibited internationally and is part of the permanent collection of many museums around the world, like the Victoria and Albert Museum in London and the Museum of Modern Art in New York. Édouard Boucat, votre projet plus récent, Télescope intérieur, est le tout premier poème conçu pour la pesanteur. Il a été créé et présenté dans l'espace en collaboration avec l'astronaute français Thomas Besquet et coordonné par l'Observatoire de l'espace, le laboratoire culturel de l'Agence spatiale française. Cet intérêt pour la question de la pesanteur vous habite depuis plus de 30 ans. Vous avez même publié en 2007 un manifeste de la poésie spatiale. Avant qu'on discute de ce poème en soi, de sa forme, de sa signification, j'aimerais que vous nous expliquiez un peu la genèse de ce projet. Le langage textuel et la poésie ont toujours fait partie de votre travail de création. Du texte était intégré à vos premières performances déjà dans les années 80. Et même dans vos œuvres de bio-art, le code et le langage sont souvent présents. Avec Télescope intérieur, vous inventez la poésie spatiale, mais vous avez inventé aussi plusieurs autres types de poésie par le passé. Par exemple, l'holopoésie dans les années 80, la biopoésie dans les années 2000, et vous avez d'ailleurs publié en 2003 le manifeste de la biopoésie et l'aroma poésie en 2011. Donc, pouvez-vous nous expliquer en quoi consiste formes de poésie novatrices et quelles sont variées avec ce projet créé dans l'espace?
The question basically takes us back to the early 80s and crosses nearly four decades arriving to the present. So basically, when I started, I started producing poetry, art, and performance in 1980. And I went through a very quick period, a very intense period from 1980 to 82, experimenting with a wide array of different media and materials. And when I completed that phase of experimentation, I came to the conclusion that throughout the history of poetry and throughout the history of art, a whole set of forces, directions, oppositions, trends that construe themselves in different ways, very often also in antinomic ways, in reality could be subsumed under a unifying category of analog. And I felt that in 1982, I felt that digital was much more than a medium. It was something that opened up the possibility of an entirely new culture, and I felt that it was important to participate in the process of developing this new culture, and most importantly, I felt that poetry would have a place in this new culture. So in 1982, I created a poem entitled No, a form of negation of the past, the construction of something different. And it was challenging to even find a venue to exhibit the work. It took me 2 years to find somebody that would be willing to exhibit the work. And in the course of doing this work, I also started in 1983, and here we begin also to see more clearly how this new space poem starts to evolve. In 1983, I created my first holographic poem. And one of the things that led me in this short period of 1983 to open up my beginning digital poetic practice into something else that was so challenging. Holography even today is somewhat challenging. Back in 83 was extremely challenging, but it's a good thing you don't know that, so just go and do it. I felt that language, as we have known it, is gravitropic. And by this term, I mean to say that the way we employ language, the way we socially construct language, language is subsumed under the larger sensorial perceptual experience that we have, conditioned by gravity. Even if it doesn't really matter if you look at Western systems of writing, say, take English, going from left to right, but then it goes down. You take non-Western systems, such as Arabic or Hebrew going from right to left, and then it goes down. You take ideographic systems, such as Chinese and Japanese, you write them vertically, and they always go down. Of course, you can use typography to go up on the page, but the point being that the way we have construed social systems of language, they follow our perception, conditioned by gravity. And writing with holography, I felt that I could begin to touch on issues that went beyond this precondition that we have conceived, we really had no prior means to question and challenge. Writing with light, and projecting light in space and time allowed me to reimagine and the language and give the reader the lived experience of this other way of thinking about language. So the important thing about this holographic practice is that writing with holography, the way we encounter holography most of the time, for example, on your credit card or the cereal box, it's primarily mimetic. So you take an object, this cup, and then you make a copy of it. And when that happens, most of these holograms are primarily three-dimensional. I was not interested in that at all. That is simply a replication of what we already know. We have seen three-dimensional typography before. That is of no interest. And when you consider why holography received the Nobel Prize in the early 70s, it becomes very clear that it was not because Denis Gabor invented a technique to make three-dimensional images. We had three-dimensional images before. That would not be Nobel Prize worthy. The reason why he received the Nobel Prize is because holography has unique, untransferable ways of storing information. And that allowed me to invent new modes of syntax specific to each poem. So for example, I created concepts such as binocular reading. So in a holographic poem, I can send one word to your left eye and an entirely different word to your right eye. This is different. This is not stereoscopy. This is not what we are accustomed to, right? In stereoscopy, we have one point of view with the left eye and a slightly different view of the same thing with the right eye. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about seeing entirely different things to one eye versus the other. This produces an experience that is not resolvable. A sensation of retinal rivalry produces a perceptual tension between these two words that cannot be resumed, that cannot be subsumed under a single concept. So take, for example, in poetological terms, take, for example, antinomic terms such as black and white. We have a very clear concept that denominates a very specific middle color. We call it gray. We know that. That word stabilizes the relationship between between signifier and signified into a concept that gains circulation in a verbal economy. Now, other attempts by poets and writers in the past to overcome that limitation, we know very well the portmanteau that Joyce has employed widely. So you take something. Things that are very disparate, say flower and chair, and then you can make a concept that would be chair flower or flower air, or you can combine two words into a portmanteau. But then again, you stabilize that fusion into a sign that can be transferred into a verbal economy, for example, in the book or into oral performance. Binocular reading is an example. There are others, I'm just giving one example. That is irresolvable, because that tension is perceived by you in a manner that only your attention can allow for that oscillation to take place, but that oscillation and that tension never resolve themselves. So this allows you to suggest semantic fields that cannot be pinned down. You cannot find a specific term that that designates that middle ground. And it's exactly that instability, it is exactly that irresolvable quality, it is exactly the fact that it's a kinesthetically dependent reading act that produces that literary quality that is unique to that moment. This is just one example, but this possibility of creating work, writing poems that are not graphimorphic, or graphotropic, as I tried to overcome with holographic poetry, already indicates a sense of a search towards this work that space poetry would later become. And in the course of time, and I produced 24 holographic poems between 83 and 93, some 18 digital poems between 82 and 98, and in the course of doing that, in 97, when I started to develop bioart, because as you might know, I have two parallel practices, one in experimental poetry and one in visual arts, and they complement each other in particular ways. When in 97, I started to develop bioart, subsequently, I felt that the living, not as a metaphor, not as an allegory, not as an idea, but a true living organism, the breathing, metabolizing organism, could be a medium for writing. And I wrote a very short biopoetry manifesto, I think in 2001 or 2 or 3, I don't quite remember. And basically outlining some ideas to be developed, some of which I have developed and have exhibited. And we have the tendency to think about the living in a manner that pretty much revolves around literary metaphors. DNA is the book of life we hear often from people. And it's very interesting to think about DNA not as a metaphor, but as medium and material. So in 1999, I created a piece called Genesis, in which I encoded a fragment of the book of Genesis. I don't have a Bible, so I went online and found a version of King James that I downloaded and copied and pasted into Microsoft Word. And of course, combining Kim James and Bill Gates, that should be enough for a critical piece of writing, but not satisfied. I went a bit further, and I created a code of my own to go from this complex natural language system of English into DNA, right? DNA is, I notice that I'm not using DNA code. I'm avoiding this language because code implies an agent that is doing the coding, implies an agent that is doing the decoding, etc. But DNA is certainly a medium that can store information, and I created a code of my own, in this case a true code, to go from natural language to Morse, normal Morse, common Morse that we know, which as we know is composed of two basic elements. I created a code to go from Morse, which has two elements, to the four elements of DNA. And then I proceeded to encode into DNA, so now the biblical statement becomes CTGA, CTGA, etc. And I sent, in 1999, that sequence via email to a company specialized in DNA synthesis. 2 weeks later, I received a file with a white powder, which you could do back in the day, send white powder in the mail. Now it's more complicated. Things are becoming more complicated in general. So I got this white powder in the mail, and it was salty. Yes, I did try it. But I don't recommend because it's dirty salt, or it's chemical salt. But in any case, you're not, when you see the white powder, you're not really looking at DNA because a single base of DNA is 2 nanometers wide, so you can't really see it very small. But it's there, it's laced in there. The point being that you are writing on your computer screen, and then with the same ease that you send an email to a friend, you're sending that sequence to a company, which then actually synthesizes that sequence and sends it back to you. So right away you see a certain level of fluidity between what is digital and what is not. And in this case, what is not being part of the continuum of life, this relationship between the living and the non-living, the digital and the biological, becomes ever more transparent, ever more a two-way road. So I then proceeded to incorporate that DNA sequence into bacteria, which viewers found in the gallery under particular circumstances. Well, one aspect of that circumstance is the fact that I placed the petri dish with the bacteria on a UV light box that viewers could activate in the gallery or from home. And this particular UV light was short-lived, meaning that it could cause mutation in the living organism. In other words, you're chilling, hanging out at home in Montreal, and with one click, you're changing the word of God in the body of bacteria and tofu. And at the end of the exhibition, I brought back the last petri dish to the lab and reversed the reading. So from that mutated bacteria, I went back to mutant English, completing the process. But you also see, when I say this, that what we perceive as being part of an entirely different realm of practice, a binary system or natural language or the living DNA itself. In this particular work from 1999, one of the early pieces that I did under the rubric of biopoetry, there is a very clear signaling of a continuum between these realms that we have perceived as being discrete. And within bioart or biopoetry, there is a lot more. I'm just trying to pick one word from each moment of development to signal this continuum that we have alluded to. More recently, prior to the space book, I published a book called Aroma Poetry, 2011 it came out. Basically, it's a book to be read with the doves. The poems themselves are olfactory. You open the book, on the left page, at the bottom of the left page, there is a title in English that you can read with your archives, but the poem itself is on the right side, and there's nothing on the page that you can see. You really have to read with your nose. They're not perfumes. They're not conceived in the cultural sphere of cosmetics. They're not conceived in the material sphere of cosmetics. They're not conceived for the skin. They would burn your skin if you tried to put them on your skin. And they're laced on the page using a nanotechnology called mesoporous glass that was handmade for the book by a group of scientists from Collège de France that I worked with. And one of the things that I see in common between the space poem and the Roman poetry and my practice in holographic poetry, for example, is this demand of a kinesthetic engagement on the part of the reader, so that reading is not only or primarily a cognitive act, but demands the engagement of the entire body. Be it undermining writing directly with the Roman poetry, or projecting the expectation that your body will be suspended in zero gravity as the space poem is, or demanding other modes of engagement with the writing in space and time as it does with the holographic poem. So I in as much as these materialities are distinct, I feel that they come from the same search, from the same drive to produce this transient form of poetry that demands the engagement of the body of the reader. Does that make sense?
Peut-être que vous pourriez, est-ce que ça fonctionne, le micro? Non? Oui? Non. Peut-être que vous pouvez nous parler aussi de comment s'est établie cette collaboration-là avec Thomas Pesquet et l'Agence spatiale européenne. Est-ce que d'entrée, ils ont bien reçu ce projet-là?
So the question is a little bit about the pragmatics of making the space poem happen. Like how do you make it happen? Well, as we just discussed, the vision, the desire, this relationship between the text and space and the kinesthetic engagement of the reader, this has been part of my desire, my vision for a long time from the very beginning. But I became an artist in residence. Well, first, in 2006, I was a poet in residence at the Biennale des Poètes en Val-de-Marne, which was directed by Jean-Pierre Bauer. And when I was in residence at the Poetry Biennale, I had the opportunity to start a dialogue with the French Space Agency. And that dialogue led to my becoming an artist in residence at the French Space Agency for 10 years. So it started that way. But there was no guarantee that anything would happen, because at that point, France did not have an active astronaut. Because the way this works, you might know this, but the way this works is that several European countries have their own space programs, but they all work together under the larger umbrella of the European Space Program. And at that particular point, France didn't have an astronaut, but I was already an artist in residence. 3 years later, Thomas Pesquet was selected. And at that point, it took him 7 years to become an astronaut, because originally he was a pilot. So that's what it takes. You know, if you're thinking about becoming a candidate astronaut, you have to be prepared to train for 7 years. So we then coincided for 7 years, but in the beginning, say in the first 5 years, it didn't make any sense to do anything tangible because he was still training. He was an astronaut in the making, so to speak. But as we got closer to the end of all that, the actual dialogue started. And we first met at the Salon des Bourget, which is the air and space salon in Paris, which is actually fascinating. It may sound boring, but it's actually fascinating. They have a museum of old airplanes. We're talking about preservation. They make an effort to preserve the old airplanes. It's actually a very interesting venue, the air and space salon. So we met there, and and then I presented project to him, and I was shocked with how quickly he understood and how well he understood. I even jokingly said, I'm going to ask you for an essay for the next catalog, because he speaks so well, and he's so bright, and understood so well, and all of this was, of course, under the aegis of the Observatoire d'Espace, which is the cultural laboratory of the French Space Agency. Without Observatoire d'Espace, this would not have happened. So we started the dialogue in that context. He immediately understood that the poem was conceived for Zero Gravity, and I think this is what interested him. He later said that he would not have been interested if it was something that was basically transported from, let's say, an earthbound culture to Zero Gravity. He understood that the poem was conceived for, specifically for Zero Gravity, and he found that to be interesting. Thomas is somebody that has an engagement, like we can say an aesthetic engagement, because his when he's not piloting rockets or airplanes, he plays the saxophone. So he's somebody that has also a sensibility. And his companion surprised him when he was aboard the space station. It was his birthday, and he managed to use the cargo to send him a saxophone. He was delighted to receive that and play the saxophone in Zero Gravity. So the fact that he had an aesthetic sensibility in the realm of music certainly contributed to facilitate this dialogue. Hmm. Well.
Qui est écrit dans l'espace, donc il est à la fois très très simple, mais vraiment très poétique, très symbolique. Je ne sais pas si la plupart d'entre vous avez vu déjà à l'exposition ILO la vidéo qui documente, puis ensuite on pourra parler de statue de l'œuvre comme telle, mais qui documente un peu comment a été créé dans l'espace cette forme-là, cet objet poétique. Mais en fait, je vais vous laisser Eduardo l'expliquer plus en détail, mais cette forme-là qui se déplace dans l'espace, elle est à la fois une représentation schématisée du corps humain. C'est en même temps des lettres qui s'imbriquent les unes dans les autres. On voit cette forme magnifique qui se déplace à l'intérieur, qui flotte dans l'espace. Donc, j'aimerais que vous parliez un petit peu de toutes ces symboliques-là qui existent dans ce petit objet, puis aussi peut-être aussi ça représente aussi le mot moi, donc il y a toute cette symbolique-là qui vient avec. Donc, vous pouvez nous expliquer un peu plus en détail. Puis peut-être aussi comment concrètement vous l'avez conçu pour qu'il soit fabriqué directement dans l'espace avec le matériel qui était déjà présent sur place.
So this is a question that is a little bit more specific about the work of the space poem itself and meetings. If you had the opportunity to see the video in the exhibition, the video is 12 minutes long, and I asked for some seats to be placed in front of the video because it's good if one can see from the beginning to the end because in the beginning of the video, we see the space station in orbit, and then it cuts to the space station where you see nobody, so we have this transition from outside to inside, and then it cuts to Thomas in the Columbus module, which is the European module, where he does a lot of his work. And then you see him, you don't see him, you don't see his face, but you do, this is deliberate because as, you know, as an artist, as a poet, I wanted to try to place the viewer in the position of the person whose arms you see making the work. So you see the search for the materials that are already in place. And you see slowly for about 4 minutes or so, you see the work being made. And this act was very important to communicate because the one important symbolic aspect of the work is the fact that it's made outside of our own planet. The fact that we will live more regularly outside of our own planet in the future. And when we do, we will certainly have to take care of some basic survival needs, shelter, food, etc. But then, because we are human and we cannot help it, we will have the urge to be creative and to express ourselves and to communicate through organized form our new experience. We will create poetry in outer space, we will make art in outer space, we will experience dance and theater and new forms of cuisine and so on and so forth. We will develop a new true space culture as time goes by. And the fact that the work is made outside of our own planet then gains this symbolic charge of making this gesture in a very tangible way and indicating this path to come. So then once he does that in the video, you see that he tries to sing it, he releases it, he tries to position it, he is learning, like a child, he's learning how this object that no one has ever made, not even himself, how it behaves in that particular environment. But you also see that it has an erratic behavior, and then very soon he begins to move down the space station. The space station, to give you an idea, is the size of a football field. It's not small. And then it begins to move, and you see this turbulent, erratic behavior of the poem. And that is also part of the desired experience. The poem is created to navigate the air currents of the space station. It functions in a way that is analogous to a boat, if you will. It has a stabilizing form, and it has what you might think of a sail to provide resistance and allow the poem to move about. And aside the fact that traditionally we wrote on paper, and here I write with paper, we also have right away a very strong contrast between this extremely hard, rigid, dry environment and this very supple, delicate, fragile object. So no wonder that the word moi, or me or myself in French, which is not signaling me, Eduardo or Thomas, but rather all of us, from a different perspective, allows us to see a stylized form that shows the arms, the head, and the legs, and the umbilical cord cut. That image of the umbilical cord cut becomes more charged with meaning when we arrive at the last five or three minutes of the video, because we find ourselves in the cupola. The cupola is the only window that is available in the space station. It's the only place where one can look out. And even then, it stays closed most of the time to protect itself from meteorites and other debris. So we look and then we see in the back our own planet, the Earth, and the poem then moves freely within the cupola and interacts with initially diffracted sunlight, because the space station goes around the Earth 16 times every 24 hours. So for one day for us, they have 16, the equivalent of 16 days. So night and day change very fast. And you see that in the video. You see the poem beginning to interact with the diffracted light of the sun, and then the light of the sun emerges in its full glory, and then the poem is very lit, and it has a reflection on the outside. And in the very back, we see the blue bubble in which we live. So it's nice if one can see the video from beginning to end. You see it, its delicate movement, its delicate bends, negotiating and rubbing against the extremely hard surface. And it's called the inner telescope in the sense that we look at ourselves in a different light under these conditions. From Earth, we point our telescopes to the sky. But when we find ourselves in the sky, we then point the telescope to ourselves.
J'ai trouvé aussi en visionnant la vidéo que même si c'est une forme de poésie et qu'on ne dit pas qu'on est devant une vidéo, il y a quand même quelque chose de très immersif avec cette œuvre-là et cette vidéo-là. On en vient presque à se sentir comme spectateur à l'intérieur de la station spatiale. Et j'ai trouvé que, bon, évidemment, les images sont magnifiques, mais une des compétences qui m'a surprise, c'est le son qui vient avec la vidéo. Donc, il y a quelque chose aussi de très, très, je trouve, qui participe de cette expérience un peu enveloppante qui provient en grande partie du son. Est-ce que c'est quelque chose qui avait été pensé à l'avance, ou c'est un peu quelque chose qui a fait partie de l'œuvre comme ça? Puis justement, est-ce qu'on peut dire pour cette œuvre-là que la vidéo que vous présentez, c'est l'œuvre, ou est-ce que la vidéo, ça reste seulement un peu une manière de documenter une performance qui a eu lieu dans l'espace, de documenter cette poésie qui existe dans l'espace?
So, the question has to do with two things. One is the sound in the video and the specific status of the video in relation to the work. So, naturally, outside the space station, there is no sound because there is no air, and air is a precondition for sound to exist. But inside the space station, you certainly have air, otherwise the astronauts would be in a very difficult situation. And when you do have air, you have sound. And it's a very noisy environment. Of course, the sound inside the space station changes continuously because there are countless instruments, all kinds of activities going on. And so it's not one sound in the entire space station. But this particular sound, it has a sort of a humming, repetitive, almost zen-like quality that also allows me to not interfere with the sensation, the floating sensation. In a sense, it helps produce that floating sensation because it communicates something about being in a space station. It's a very specific quality of sound of that environment, but it's a non-intrusive sound at the same time. It creates a somewhat soft background quality that makes itself present, but does not take your attention away. You know, it integrates itself in that way. So I thought that worked, that created a harmonious And this video is not a documentary video. That's a poetic, artistic video. It only exists in an edition of 5 copies. There is, however, a documentary video that was released last year as a regular DVD. And in the vitrine at the entrance of the exhibition, there are some of my books, and this DVD is there as well. It was published by a Paris-based publisher called Apin, and it was produced by the Observatoire de l'Espace, the cultural lab of the French space station, and it was directed by Virginie Babinat, who is a Paris-based film director. This is a classic documentary, so we have both. And in the documentary, you really follow the entire adventure of making this work come to life. We have interviews with Thomas, with myself. We have a video of Thomas and I training each other at the European Astronaut Training Center in Cologne. We see Thomas in the rocket going up, you know, and in the documentary, we do see his face. We do see him, the body, the whole Thomas, working with the piece, because it's different, right? There you're basically from the outside, you're looking at it in a more synagogical manner, which is different from my video, which I tried to place the viewer in the position of the person who is having the experience. So in reality, we have both.
And
we said
that the des expositions collectives, mais aussi en exposition solo, elle a été présentée à Paris, puis au Janeiro, en septembre prochain, elle sera à Chicago, à Derrière le Monde, à New York l'année prochaine. Ce que je trouve intéressant, c'est le fait que quand elle a été exposée dans une exposition solo, il y a cette vidéo qui est donc en soi une œuvre, mais il y a aussi plusieurs œuvres qui là sont faites à partir d'un médium beaucoup plus traditionnel, qui gravitent toujours autour de ces mêmes sujets thématiques qui sont abordés à travers l'œuvre principale, en guillemets. Donc, il y a des dessins, des broderies même, des vidéos, des photographies et aussi des lettres. Donc ça, c'est quelque chose qui revient souvent dans votre pratique. Quand vous avez exposé des œuvres de Bioart, il y a toujours un peu ces œuvres périphériques, si on veut. Donc, j'aimerais que vous nous parliez un peu de ce que ça représente pour vous, ces autres œuvres. Est-ce que c'est une manière de poursuivre la réflexion? Est-ce que c'est une manière de garder des traces, des fois, de des œuvres qui sont éphémères? Est-ce que, voilà, j'aimerais ça.
So the question is about the Inner Telescope series, in which beyond the video there are drawings, embroideries, photographs, artist books, and other works. And in this particular case, you know, I don't really like to produce anything unless it's real. So I didn't. For the most of the 10 years, until the work was really becoming real, I didn't do anything about this. But as the dialogue with Thomas gained momentum, and the French Space Agency, they published a journal, and they did an interview, so the relationships were getting closer and closer, you know, and the project was gaining momentum. And in 2014, they wanted to have a more clear sense of what that might be like. So I shot photographs in my backyard, the beautiful Chicago blue sky, of me sort of throwing the work, you know, up in the air, just to see what would happen. Of course, you have resistance, you have aerodynamic issues. I mean, it was not. But, and so those photographs existed, and I sent them to begin to build a dossier. And then in 2015, they wanted drawings to visualize Thomas in space and the work. So I made about 50 drawings, you know, initially, privately, to build up the dossier, the internal dossier, because you might imagine that to convince everyone involved in the program that this should be realized was not a trivial matter, to put it mildly. So to build this dossier very gently, very carefully, and very seriously, and very consistently was very important. So I did that, so I had the photos, and the photographs also helped me establish a visual record of the protocol, because an astronaut's time is always in high demand. They have to execute all kinds of tasks. So I have to be very clear about the steps that have to be carried out. So creating the photographs, I also photographed my hand making it, which allowed me to later transform that into a vinyl installation. So let me take advantage of this and say that Fula, who is here, is the curator of my exhibition, among other things, she will perform tomorrow at A-Level. Opening September 7th in Chicago, so if you happen to be around, we'll be open for about a month or so, more or less. And we're going to have some of these works on view at the exhibition, including this vinyl piece that runs the whole, the gamut of the whole wall, and then you see the protocol. You can get a taste for that because one of the artist books that I have in the vitrine at the entrance of the exhibition is exactly that. It's an artist book that shows my hand making and establishing the visual protocol for Thomas to follow. So all of this evolved very naturally, and as a result, has that indexical quality of being directly related and helping create the conditions for the emergence of the work. And for that reason, I feel that they're not peripheral, but in fact central to make the work possible.
We have been playing shows on
the
plein de questions que j'avais à poser encore, mais on voulait prendre un temps pour prendre des questions aussi du public. Donc, je pense qu'on manque de temps, on est déjà un petit peu en retard. Bertrand me fait des grands signes de tête. Donc, est-ce qu'il y en a parmi vous qui ont des questions à poser à l'avocat?
As a Brazilian, I usually think of poetry off the paper as a kind of art that defies the linear writing, paper writing. But in the sense of, I think, corporate poetry, we're looking for spontaneity. And what you said made me think of another kind of temporality. All the works you were describing seem to have, that they had a certain time to develop that you discovered. I would like you to talk a little bit about your work and temporality.
It is indeed very interesting because, for example, with the biopolis, the notion of temporality is quite unique. I have made a series of works called biotopes, and one of them, biotopes are works, think of this painting here, for example, imagine something more or less along the same scale, and that hangs on the wall, but it's alive like you and I. It's actually living and metabolizing. And when you encounter it, you do read, but the true writing act occurs as time goes by, and the words that you see disappear, because when the work is living and metabolizing, that means that it's active, which means that the text is beginning to disappear. But that is something that is internal to it. And just as we are human, we have that category in common, but we're all different. Each biotope even though they're all biotopes, each one would be different forcibly. They have to be fed. They have to be fed with nutrients. They have to be fed with light. They also need water. They're truly alive, and it's right. And it's not something that we can control because the metabolism is something that also depends, for example, on temperature. It's quite cold in here now, and that would slow down the metabolism, right? So there are factors that escape our control, and each of my poems then deal with temporality in different ways. Of course, when you write digital works, you program that temporality, but viewers will explore in different ways. And in the case of a holographic poem, you're certainly right in pointing out the different avant-garde movements, especially up until the 60s, have explored notions of simultaneity. We see that, for example, in comics, we see that in Apollinaire, we certainly see that in the early modes of visual poetry that emerged in the 50s. The Lattrists, working in the 40s, were very interested in what later became known as sound poetry, which is a different mode of temporality. But holographic poetry, very consciously, very deliberately, sought to negate the notion of simultaneity. There is no, deliberately, by design, there is no gestalt in a holographic poem. Deliberately, at the level of the creation of the syntax of each holographic poem, there is a very conscious attempt to avoid the possibility that from any point of view, you would be able to see the totality of the verbal material presented to you. Because the way I created holographic poetry, as I said before, you could take a text and make a mimetic hologram of that and see the whole thing at once, in which case you're basically staying within a pre-established tradition and you're just using another medium to create the same syntax. That is not what I do, right? Because holography allows you to manipulate space-time structures, not many people do, but the medium does allow you to do that. I create discontinuities in my whole poems. And that is why you have to do a little dance in front of the whole poems. You can squat down, you can stretch your legs, you move a little bit from left to right, you go further away, a little closer. Information is actually very actively traveling in different directions of space and time. And if you do not place yourself in that particular trajectory, you simply do not see it. Even though the entire hologram is in front of you, from no perspective can you possibly ever have the gestalt experience that characterized the avant-garde of the 50s. And that is done in a very deliberate and conscious way to invent new modes of syntax.
Mm-hmm. We have time only for one question. I'm sorry.
Hi, this is going on with AJ, about the holographic poems and the fact that you have one word going into your left eye, one word going into your right eye, and there's this tension between the two that can't really be resolved. Would something like that be able to be done with virtual reality, which folks done simulate kind of binocular system, or just end up a holography that, you know, is sort of medium specific to that particular kind of technology?
You could, but it's different because of the way that virtual reality works. You find this experience is known in optics as retinal rivalry, and Helmholtz already in the 19th century explored that in a stereoscope. But the problem with the stereoscope is that it locks your head into a single position, right? And that stability, even though it allows you to experience that, it's not a natural mode of experience. And my feeling is that if you could technically do that with virtual reality, you could send, you know, microphone to the left eye and chair to the right eye, and you would produce that, but you would be experiencing two-dimensional images as Helmholtz did in the 19th century. but because every single image that I send to your left eye or your right eye is truly a holographic image, you're not only are you experiencing full three-dimensionality with each eye in that sense, but your body is free to move about. And this creates a much a more natural mode of exploration of the text. And so technically, yes, you can do that, but you might run into the same type of constraint that Helmholtz first had with the microscope.
Merci à tous.